This is disc number 5.
I don't want anyone from the CIA on my team. He'll just get in the way, and besides, I fully anticipate we'll be doing things that violate American law. I can't have him stopping every 5 minutes to consult with his Washington lawyer. I'm afraid I have to insist. All right, Adrian. We'll let you come along. Nothing would make me happier. But leaving headquarters is not an option, at least not at the moment. I do have another candidate in mind, someone who's experienced in the field and has been forged by fire. And the best part is, you trained her. Gabriel stopped walking. You can't be serious. I'm quite serious. Where is she? The Saudi desk at the Counterterrorism Center. How soon can she be ready to leave? I'll make one phone call, and she's yours. Chapter 19. Off Le Havre, France. 4:49 p.m. Saturday. The lights of the French coastline pricked the darkness off the prow of the Portsmouth to Le Havre ferry. The man seated near the observation windows in the upper lounge glanced at his wristwatch. 30 minutes remained of the 5-hour crossing. He signaled the waitress and, with a small gesture of his hand, ordered another Carlsberg, his 4th of the journey. She brought it a moment later and placed it suggestively on his table. She had bleached blonde hair and a jewel stud in her lower lip. Her name tag said, Christine. The man stared directly at her, the way infidel men always stared at their women, and allowed his eyes to wander over her breasts.
You have a name? She asked.
Thomas, he said. It wasn't his real name. It was borrowed, like his borrowed driver's license and borrowed British passport. His Yorkshire accent was the real thing. He was a Yorkshire lad, born and bred.
I could be wrong, Thomas, but I think you have an admirer.
Oh, really? Who? The waitress glanced toward the other side of the lounge. Seated alone at a table near the opposite window was a small woman in her mid-twenties, with short dark hair and stormy black eyes. She was dressed in tight jeans and a snug-fitting pullover embroidered with the word, "Oui."
She's been looking at you ever since we left Portsmouth, the waitress said. Can't keep her eyes off you, actually.
Not my type.
What is your type?
He remembered the words his controller had spoken during the final briefing. Whatever you do, don't sit by yourself looking as though you are a terrorist. Strike up a conversation, buy someone a drink. Flirt with a girl if there's a girl to flirt with. I like girls named Christine who serve drinks on channel ferries.
You don't say.
She smiled at him. He felt his stomach churn with rage.
When are you going back to England?
She asked. Tomorrow, midday.
What a coincidence. I'm going back on the same boat. I'll see you then, I hope.
Cheers to that. The waitress walked back to the bar. The man with the Yorkshire accent raised his beer to his lips and, before taking a swallow, begged Allah for forgiveness. He had done other things during the past few days for which he had sought Allah's pardon. He had shaved his beard for the first time since he was a teenager, and had dyed his dark hair platinum blonde to look more like a native European. He had eaten pork sausage in a roadside cafe in Britain, and had spoken to many women with unveiled faces. He had sought no absolution, however, for his role in the kidnapping of the American woman. Her father served the Crusader regime, a regime that oppressed Muslims around the world, a regime that supported Israel while the Palestinians suffered, a regime that supported an apostate thug like Hosni Mubarak, who grew rich while the Egyptian people slipped deeper into poverty and despair with each passing day. The American woman was nothing more than a tool to be used to secure the release of Sheikh Abdullah from the Crusader jail, an infidel cow that could be taken to market, and if necessary, slaughtered without mercy and without fear of Allah's retribution. A voice crackled over the ship's loudspeaker. It was the captain, informing the passengers that the ferry would soon make landfall. The man in the bar finished the rest of his beer, then headed down a flight of stairs to the vehicle loading deck. The silver LDV Maxus panel van was parked in the center column, 3 rows from the stern. He opened the rear doors and peered into the darkened cargo area. Inside were several dozen large crates that bore the markings of fine bone china from a manufacturer in Yorkshire. The shipment, which was fully documented, was bound for an exclusive shop in the French city of Strasbourg, a shop that happened to be owned by an Egyptian with close links to the Sword of Allah. Several of the crates had been opened by British police at the Portsmouth ferry terminal, presumably in an effort to locate the missing American woman. Their search had uncovered nothing besides fine bone china from Yorkshire. The man closed the rear doors, then walked around to the driver's side and climbed behind the wheel. The dark-haired girl from the lounge bar was now seated in the passenger seat, her snug-fitting pullover concealed by a heavy leather jacket.
"It looked to me like you actually enjoyed flirting with that infidel cow," the girl said.
I wanted to slap her face the entire time.
"She's definitely going to remember you," the girl said. "In fact, she's going to remember us both."
He smiled. That was exactly the point. 5 minutes later, the ferry eased into the landing at Le Havre. The man with platinum blonde hair and a Yorkshire accent guided the van onto French soil and headed for Rennes. Chapter 20. Andrews Air Force Base, 2:17 p.m., Saturday.
"So, whose bright idea was this anyway?" asked Sarah Bancroft. "Yours or Adrian's?"
Gabriel looked at the woman seated opposite him in the passenger cabin of the CIA Gulfstream 5. She had shoulder-length blonde hair, skin the color of alabaster, and eyes like a cloudless summer sky. Dressed as she was now, in a cashmere pullover, trim faded jeans, and shapely leather boots, she was dangerously attractive.
"It was definitely Adrian's. You, of course, balked at the suggestion."
"Absolutely."
"Why did you cave?"
"It was either a knuckle-dragger from the clandestine service or you. Naturally, I chose you."
"It's good to know one is wanted."
"I didn't want anyone. Adrian insisted we include someone from the agency, and you seemed like the least harmful option. After all, we trained you. You know some of our personnel, and you know how we operate. You know the difference between a Baudel and a Naviot officer. You speak our language." He frowned. "Well, almost. I suppose the fact you don't speak Hebrew is an advantage. It means we can still talk about you behind your back."
"I can only imagine the things you all said about me."
"Rest assured, it was all complimentary, Sarah. You were the quickest study any of us had ever seen, but then we always knew you would be. That's why we chose you in the first place." "Actually, it was Adrian Carter who had chosen her." "You find the painting," Carter had said. "I'll get you the girl." The painting Gabriel had found was a lost masterpiece by Van Gogh called Marguerite Gachet at Her Dressing Table, which had vanished after Vincent's death into the private collection of a Paris lawyer. Carter had managed to find a lost masterpiece of his own, a European-educated multilingual art historian who was working as a curator at the Phillips Collection Museum in Washington, D.C. Gabriel had used her to penetrate the business entourage of a Saudi billionaire terrorist financier named Zizi al-Bakari, and her life had never been the same since.
"You know, Gabriel, if I'm not mistaken, that might well have been the first compliment you ever paid me. During my preparation for the al-Bakari operation, you barely said a word to me. You left me in the hands of your instructors and the other members of your team. Why was that?"
Greeted by silence, she answered her own question.
"Maybe you had to keep your distance. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been able to send me into Zizi's camp. Who knows? Maybe you liked me a little too much."
"My feelings for you were strictly professional, Sarah.
I wasn't suggesting otherwise."
She was silent for a moment.
"You know, after the operation ended, I missed you all terribly. You were the first real family I ever had."
She hesitated, then added,
"I even missed you, Gabriel. I almost got you killed." "Oh, that."
She looked down and made a church steeple of her ringless fingers.
"It wasn't your fault. It was mine. It was a beautiful operation. I'll let you in on a little secret. The agency isn't as good as the office. Our operations are like bricks and mortar. Yours are like..."
She paused, searching for the right word.
"Like art," she said. "They're like one of your grandfather's paintings."
"My grandfather was a German expressionist," Gabriel said. "Some of his paintings were rather chaotic and violent."
"And so are your operations."
Sarah reclined her seat and propped one boot on the armrest of Gabriel's chair. An image flashed in Gabriel's memory. Sarah, in a black veil, chained to a torturer's table in a chalet in the mountains of Switzerland.
"You're looking at me that way again," she said.
"Which way is that?"
"The way you used to look at that Van Gogh we sold to Zizi. You used to look at me and Marguerite Gachet the same way. You're assessing me. You're looking for losses and abrasions. You're wondering whether the canvas can be brought back to life, or whether it's beyond repair."
"What's the answer?"
"The canvas is fine, Gabriel. It doesn't need any work at all. In fact, it's quite suitable for hanging just as it is."
"No more nightmares?
No more sessions with the agency psychologists?"
"I wouldn't go that far."
She looked down again, and a shadow seemed to pass over her eyes. "No one at Langley knows what Elizabeth Halton is going through better than I do. Maybe that's why Adrian chose me for this assignment. He's a former case officer. He knows how to push buttons."
"I've noticed that."
She looked up at him as the Gulf Stream swept down the runway.
"So, where are we going?"
"First, we're going to make a brief stop in Tel Aviv to assemble my team. Then we're going to Amsterdam to have a quiet word with a man who's going to help us find Elizabeth Halton."
"Anyone I know?"
"Probably not."
"Tell me about him," she said.
Gabriel waited until the plane was airborne. Then he told her everything. It was shortly after dawn the next morning when they arrived at King Saul Boulevard in Tel Aviv. Gabriel stopped briefly at the operations desk to collect Eli Levon's first surveillance photographs and watch reports from Amsterdam, then led Sarah along a subterranean corridor to a doorway marked 456C. For many years, the room was nothing but a dumping ground for obsolete computers and worn-out office furniture, often used by the night staff as a place for romantic trysts. Now it was known throughout King Saul Boulevard as Gabriel's lair. Affixed to the door was a faded paper sign, written in his own stylish Hebrew hand, that read, "Temporary Committee for the Study of Terror Threats in Western Europe." The sign had served him well through two tumultuous operations. Gabriel decided to leave it for now. He opened the combination lock, then switched on the fluorescent lights and stepped inside. The room was precisely as he had left it a year earlier. One wall was covered by surveillance photographs, another by a diagram of a global business empire, and a third by a collection of impressionist prints. Gabriel's chalkboard stood forlornly in the corner, its surface bare except for a single name: Sarah Bancroft. She followed him inside tentatively, as though entering a forgotten room from her childhood, and stared at the photographs. Zizi al-Bakari with his spoiled daughter, Nadia, at his side. Abdul and Abdul, his American-educated lawyers. Herr Verli, his Swiss banker. Mr. Bin Talal, his chief of security. Jean-Michel, his French personal trainer, and Sarah's main tormentor. She turned around and looked at Gabriel.
"You planned it all from here?"
He nodded his head slowly. She looked around the room with her eyes narrowed in disbelief.
"Somehow, I expected something more..."
Her voice trailed off. But then she added,
"Something more impressive."
"This is the office, Sarah. Not Langley. We like to do things the old-fashioned way."
"Obviously." She looked at his chalkboard. "I haven't seen one of those since I was in grade school."
Gabriel smiled, then began removing the debris of the al-Bakari operation from the walls of the room as the other members of his team trickled slowly through the door. No introductions were necessary, for Sarah knew and adored them all. The first to arrive was Yossi, a tall, balding intellectual from the office's research division, who had read classics at Oxford and still spoke Hebrew with a pronounced British accent. Next came Dina Sarid, a veritable encyclopedia of terrorism from the history division, who could recite the time, place, and casualty count of every act of violence ever committed against the State of Israel. 10 minutes later came Yaakov, a battle-hardened case officer from the Arab Affairs Department of Shabak, followed by Ramona, an IDF major who served as an analyst for AMAN, Israel's Military Intelligence Service. Oded, a brooding, all-purpose field operative who specialized in snatches, arrived at 8 with breakfast for everyone. And Mordecai,
A wispy figure who dealt in all things electronic stumbled in 15 minutes later, looking as though he had not slept the night before. The last to arrive was Mikhail, a gray-eyed gunman of Russian birth, who had single-handedly killed half of the terrorist infrastructure of Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. It was because of Mikhail and his proficiency with the handgun that Sarah was alive. She kissed his cheek as Gabriel walked to the front of the room and pinned Levon's surveillance photographs to the bulletin board. "Now that we're all reacquainted," he said, "it's time to get to work. This is the man who's going to lead us to Elizabeth Halton. He is a founding member of the Sword of Allah, currently living in Amsterdam. We're going to make him vanish into thin air, and we're going to squeeze him dry. We have to work quickly, and we're not going to make any mistakes." The office prided itself on its ability to improvise in times of crisis, but even the vaunted office chafed under the pressure of Gabriel's demands. Safe accommodations were his biggest concern, and housekeeping, the division that maintained and acquired office properties, was his most stubborn opponent. Unlike cities such as Paris, London, and Rome, where the office maintained dozens of safe flats, Amsterdam had no standing inventory of secure lodging. That meant accommodations had to be acquired quickly and on the open market, something the notoriously deliberate housekeeping never liked to do. By 10 o'clock, they had taken a 6-month lease on a 2-bedroom apartment on the Herengracht Canal, and by 11, they had secured a luxury houseboat on the Prinsengracht called the Helene. That left only a site for the interrogation. Gabriel needed something large enough for his entire team and remote enough so that their presence would go undetected. He had a property in mind, a tumble-down country house outside Oldenburg that they had used during the Wrath of God operation, and eventually he was able to pry it from housekeeping's grasp. Once housekeeping capitulated, the rest fell like dominoes. By noon, travel had lined up a string of untraceable rental cars, and by 1, identity had coughed up enough clean passports to allow every member of the team to travel as a European. Banking section initially balked at Gabriel's request for a briefcase filled with petty cash, but at 1:30 he staged what amounted to an armed stick-up and left banking 10 minutes later carrying a handsome attaché case filled with $50,000 and another $50,000 in well-circulated euros. By the middle of the afternoon, the first members of his team were slipping quietly from King Saul Boulevard and heading off to Ben Gurion. Oded, Mordecai, and Ramona left at 3:30 and boarded a flight to Brussels. Yossi, Yaakov, and Dina left an hour later on a Lufthansa flight to Frankfurt. Gabriel and Sarah left last and, shortly after 8 o'clock, they were taking their seats in the first-class section of El Al's evening flight to Paris. As the rest of the passengers filed on board, Gabriel telephoned Chiara to tell her he had been in the country and was leaving again. She didn't ask where he was going. She didn't need to know. Chapter 21. Imbaba, Cairo, 8:23 a.m., Sunday. The Cairo slum known as Imbaba is one of the most desperately poor places on earth. Located just across the Nile from the fashionable island district of Zamalek, Imbaba is so crowded its rickety tenement buildings often collapse beneath the weight of their occupants. The alleys are unpaved, without names, and in perpetual darkness. They run with raw sewage and are choked with mounds of uncollected garbage. At night they are ruled by packs of wild dogs. The children of Imbaba wear rags, drink from cesspools, and live in fear of being eaten alive by the rats. There is little running water, only brief interludes of electricity, and even less hope. Only Islam. Radical Islam. It is written on the crumbling walls in green spray paint. Islam is the answer. Only the sword can save us. The mood in Imbaba that morning was more tense than usual. Riot police were roaming the alleyways, and SSI men in plain clothes were surveying their surroundings from coffee shops and falafel stands. Hussein Mandali, a fourth-grade teacher at the Imbaba Middle School, had seen it like this before. The security forces were about to move in for a sweep. Any man with a beard and a jalabiya, or any woman in a niqab, would be arrested and thrown into the Scorpion, the dreaded facility inside Cairo's Torah prison complex reserved for Islamists. Everyone, regardless of sex, would spend at least a few minutes on the torture table. Pharaoh's secret police did not concern themselves much with laws or rules of evidence. Their task was to instill fear, and they did so with ruthless efficiency. Hussein Mandali did not wear a beard, though he did dress in the jalabiya, the only garment he could afford on his pittance of a salary. Egypt's education system, like nearly everything else in the country, was crumbling. Teachers earned nothing, and students learned little. For many years, the country's 25,000 public schools had been under the control of Islamists. As a result, they were little more than factories that each year churned out thousands of young men and women committed to the destruction of the regime and its supporters in the West. Hussein Mandali knew this phenomenon all too well. He lectured his students daily on the rewards of jihad and martyrdom, and told them it was their sacred duty to kill Americans and Jews and topple their puppet, Hosni Mubarak. The children of Imbaba were always willing recruits. The proof of Pharaoh's indifference to their plight was all around them. A group of police officers was standing guard at the end of the street. They eyed Mandali suspiciously as he slipped past without a word and set out along the cacophonous boulevard overlooking the western bank of the Nile. 2 minutes later, he turned left onto a bridge and crossed over onto Zamalek. How different it was here, he thought. Zamalek was an island of privilege surrounded by a sea of misery, a place where the vast majority of Egypt's population could not afford to buy a pastry or a cup of coffee. Zamalek would soon feel the wrath of Egypt's legions of downtrodden Muslims, Mandali thought. So would the entire world. He followed July 26th Street across the island, then wandered for a time through the quiet side streets north of the Gezira Sporting Club to make certain he wasn't being followed. 30 minutes after leaving Imbaba, he approached a luxury high-rise apartment house called the Ramses Towers. The tall Sudanese standing guard over the entrance was a member of the Sword of Allah. He guided Mandali into the marble lobby and instructed him to use the back staircase so that none of the other tenants would see a poor man in their gilded elevator. As a result, Mandali was heavily winded when he presented himself at the door of apartment 2408 and knocked in the prescribed fashion. Two knocks, followed by a brief pause, then three more knocks. The door was opened a few seconds later by a man dressed in a pale gray jalabiya. He admitted Mandali into a formal entrance hall, then showed him into a magnificent sitting room overlooking the Nile. Seated, cross-legged on the floor, dressed in a white jalabiya and a crocheted white skullcap, was an elderly man with a long gray beard. Hussein Mandali kissed the old man's leathery cheeks and sat before him.
"You have news from the street?"
asked Sheikh Tayyib Abdul Razak.
"Mubarak's forces have surrounded Imbaba and have started to infiltrate the district. In other parts of the country, the army and the police are hitting us very hard. Fayoum, Minya, Assiut, and Luxor have all seen heavy raids. The situation is tense. One spark and it could explode."
The Sheikh fingered his prayer beads and looked at the other man.
"Bring me a tape recorder," he said, "and I'll give you a spark."
The man laid the recorder at the feet of the sheikh and switched it on. 1 hour later, Hussein Mandali was once again picking his way through the alleys of Imbaba, this time with a cassette tape concealed inside his sock. By nightfall, the sermon would be circulating through a network of popular mosques and underground jihadist cells. After that, it would be in the hands of Allah. Hussein Mandali was sure of only one thing. The open sewers of Imbaba would soon be flowing red with the blood of Pharaoh's soldiers. Chapter 22. Amsterdam, 9:30 a.m., Monday. Helene was squat and boxy, painted chocolate brown and trimmed in red. Flower boxes lined her gunwales, and a skiff with an outboard motor bobbed at her stern. Her interior had been recently renovated. Stainless steel appliances shone in the small but sophisticated kitchen, and Scandinavian-style furniture adorned the comfortable sitting room. 3 modern paintings of questionable taste had been removed from the walls, and in their place hung a large-scale map of Amsterdam and several dozen surveillance photographs of a Muslim man of late middle age. A notebook computer with secure communication software stood on the glass dining room table, and before it sat a small figure who seemed to be wearing all of his clothing at once. Gabriel pleaded with him to extinguish his cigarette. The overnight drive from Paris had left him with a splitting headache.
If Ibrahim Fawaz is a terrorist, he certainly doesn't act like one,
Eli Levon said.
He doesn't engage in anything that might be construed as rudimentary counter-surveillance, and his movements are predictable and direct.
Gabriel looked up at the map of Amsterdam on the wall, where Ibrahim's daily routine was represented by a thick red line. It ran from his apartment in the Auguste Alibiplein to the West Amsterdam Islamic Community Center, then to the Tin Cotta Market, and finally to the El Hijra Mosque. Times of arrival and departure were meticulously noted and supported by photographic evidence.
Where?
Gabriel asked. Where should we take him? Levon stood and walked over to the map.
In my learned opinion, there's only one spot that's suitable. Here.
He stabbed the map twice with his stubby forefinger.
At the end of the Jan Hasenstraat. He walks by there on the way home from evening prayers at the mosque. It's reasonably quiet for Amsterdam, and if we can take out the street lamps, you'll never see us coming.
He turned and looked at Gabriel.
When are you thinking about doing it?
The answer came from the kitchen, where Sarah was making a fresh pot of coffee.
Tonight,
she said.
We have no choice but to take him tonight and start the interrogation. Tonight!
Levon looked at Gabriel and gave him an incredulous smile.
A year ago, I was teaching this child how to walk the street like a professional. Now she is telling me that I have to kidnap a man from a densely populated European city after watching him for less than 48 hours. Unfortunately, the child is right, Eli. We have to do it tonight and get started.
Levon sat down again and folded his arms.
Do you remember how long I watched Zweder in Rome before we even began talking about how to kill him? 3 weeks. And that was for an assassination, not a kidnapping. And you know what Chamron always says about kidnap operations.
He says it's much easier to leave a dead man on the sidewalk than it is to get a live one into a getaway car.
Gabriel smiled. Chamron does have a way with words, doesn't he? Sarah brought the pot of coffee to the table and sat down next to Gabriel. Levon lit a cigarette and blew a stream of smoke toward the ceiling in frustration.
The police in this city are on high alert because of the links between the Amsterdam cell and the attack in London, he said. We need to watch Ibrahim for at least another week. We have to plan a primary escape route, a backup escape route, and a backup to the backup escape route. We have to put the snatch zone under 24-hour surveillance so we know there won't be any surprises on the night of the operation. Have I forgotten anything?
The dry runs, said Gabriel. We should make at least 3 dry runs.
And in a perfect world, we would do all those things.
But in the real world, Elizabeth Halton has less than 5 days to live. We prepare as much as we can, but we take him tonight.
And we pray to God we don't end up in jail, which is what's going to happen if we make a mistake.
Levon gazed despondently at his wristwatch.
Let's take a walk over to the Oud-West. Who knows? It might be our last opportunity for a very long time.
The bustling outdoor market that ran for several blocks along the Tin Cotta Straat reflected the altered demographics of Amsterdam's Oud-West neighborhood. There were dates and lentils, barrels filled with olives and chickpeas, shawarma stands and falafel vendors, and 3 different halal butchers. Gabriel paused briefly in the open-air shoe store and picked through a pile of counterfeit American basketball shoes, the ultimate status symbol of the young, even among the street toughs of West Amsterdam. At the stall on the opposite side of the street, Sarah was scrutinizing a canvas book bag emblazoned with the face of Che Guevara, while Levon was feigning interest in a hooded sweatshirt that proclaimed, "Free Palestine now." Levon looked at Gabriel and gave an almost imperceptible nod of his head, the signal that he had detected no surveillance. A moment later, they were all 3 walking side by side toward the far end of the market. The stall where Ibrahim Fawaz worked in the afternoon was occupied by an elderly Moroccan man in a white jalaba. Sarah paused to examine an electric tea kettle while Gabriel and Levon walked on to the end of the market. On the opposite side of the street, in a drab post-war building, was the Al Hijra Mosque. 2 bearded men were conversing outside on the pavement under the watchful gaze of 2 uniformed Amsterdam policemen. 20 yards away was a dark van with blacked-out windows.
It hasn't moved in 48 hours, Levon said.
Dutch security. Levon nodded. If I had to guess, I'd say they have a static post in the building across the street as well.
Gabriel looked back toward the kitchen supplies stall and motioned for Sarah to join them. Then they turned to the left and walked along the Jan Hassenstraße. It was a quiet street lined with squat, mismatched tenement buildings and small storefronts. At the far end, overlooking a broad canal, was a tiny park with a few benches, a swing set, and a pair of rusted hobby horses on steel springs. Gabriel rounded the corner to the left and paused. More apartment blocks, but no storefronts or cafes. Nothing that would be open after dark.
Evening prayers begin tonight at 6:37, Levon said. Which means that Ibrahim will be passing by this spot at approximately 7 o'clock. Once he comes around the corner, no one in the van or the static post will be able to see him. We just have to make sure we get him without making any noise. I recommend we put the getaway vehicle on this corner where the Dutch agents can't see it. Then we have to do something that makes Ibrahim slow down long enough so that we can get him cleanly.
Gabriel thought of the night he and Ibrahim had walked along the Amstel River together, and a single image flashed in his memory. Ibrahim Fawaz lowering his gaze in disgust as two men strolled toward them, arm in arm.
He doesn't like homosexuals, Gabriel said.
Few Islamists do, Levon replied.
What do you have in mind?
Gabriel told him. Levon smiled.
To whom do you intend to give this assignment?
Mikhail and Yaakov, Gabriel said without hesitation.
Perfect, said Eli Levon. But you tell them. Those boys make me nervous.
Chapter 23. The White House. 12:45 p.m., Monday. There was no mistaking the perpetrator of the assault on the door of Nicholas Scanlon's office. Two knocks, sharp as a tack hammer. The White House press secretary allowed 10 uncomfortable seconds to elapse before looking up from his work. Melissa Stewart, NBC's chief White House correspondent, was leaning against the door jamb, her arms folded defiantly, her newly tinted hair tousled from her last live shot on the North Lawn.
What's on your mind, Melissa?
We need to talk.
No paper in the ladies' room again?
Stewart stepped inside the office and closed the door.
Please come in, Melissa, Scanlon said sarcastically. Have a seat.
I'd love to, Nick, but I'm in a bit of a rush.
What can I do for you?
Confirm a story.
Scanlon shuffled the papers on his desk and played for time.
What have you got?
I know who's holding Elizabeth Halton hostage.
Do tell, Melissa, we'd all like to know.
It's the Sword of Allah, Nick. A few days ago, a DVD of Elizabeth was left in the countryside of southern England. They want Sheikh Abdullah back, and if we don't have him on a plane bound for Egypt by Friday night, they're going to kill her.
What's your source?
That doesn't sound like a denial.
Answer the question, please.
You don't really expect me to divulge my source, do you?
At least characterize the nature of the source for me.
Law enforcement, she said. But that's as far as I go.
Scanlon swiveled his chair around and gazed through his bulletproof window toward the North Lawn.
A fucking leak.
It was a miracle they had managed to keep a lid on it this long. It had been just 6 months since Scanlon had left his lucrative job as a lobbyist and public relations executive to come to work for the president. But in that time he had been given ample evidence of Washington's proclivity to leak. And the worse the news, the faster it gushed out. He wondered what would possibly motivate a federal law enforcement official to slip a piece of news like this to a reporter. He rotated his chair around and looked into Melissa Stewart's large blue eyes. But of course, he thought.
You still sleeping with that guy from the Bureau?
Stay out of my personal life, Nick. I'm going to give you a piece of advice, and I hope you take it in the spirit it is offered.
This is not a story you want to be first on.
That doesn't sound like a denial either.
As you can imagine, we are in the middle of some very delicate operations around the globe right now. Operations that will be placed in jeopardy if this news is revealed before we are ready.
I'm sorry, Nick, but this is just too big to sit on. If it's true, we have to go with it. The American people deserve to know who's holding Ambassador Halton's daughter.
Even if it gets her killed.
You've sunk into the depths before, but that's the lowest.
I can go much lower, Melissa. I'll deny it's true, and then I'll denounce you from the podium.
She turned and reached for the doorknob.
Wait, Scanlon said, his tone suddenly conciliatory.
Perhaps we can reach an accommodation.
What do you have in mind?
How long can you give me?
10 minutes.
20, Scanlon countered.
15.
Scanlon nodded in agreement. Stewart looked at her watch.
If the phone in my booth doesn't ring in 15 fucking minutes, she said, I'm going to march out to the lawn and tell the world who's holding Elizabeth Halton.
The president was seated at his desk when Nicholas Scanlon entered the Oval Office 3 minutes later, accompanied by White House Chief of Staff William Burns and National Security Advisor Cyrus Mansfield.
Why the long faces, gentlemen?
The president asked.
There's been a leak, Mr. President, Scanlon said. NBC knows who's holding Elizabeth.
The president closed his eyes in frustration. For more than a week now, he had been walking a fine line, attempting to show appropriate concern in public for the fate of his friend's daughter, while at the same time making it clear to the terrorists that they had not managed to incapacitate the most powerful man on the planet. Only those closest to the president knew the physical and emotional toll the kidnapping had taken on him.
What do you suggest, Nick?
Taking the bull by the horns, sir.
I think it would be better for the country and the rest of the world to hear the news from your mouth than Melissa Stewart's.
How long do we have before she goes on the air with it?
Scanlon looked at his watch.
9 minutes, sir.
The president looked from his press secretary to his national security advisor.
I need to know whether I'm going to be placing any sensitive operations in jeopardy if I go public now. Get the director of the CIA on the line, the secretary of state, too.
Yes, sir.
The president looked at Scanlon again.
Assuming no one has any objections, where would you like to do this?
The briefing room feels appropriate to me.
No questions, though.
I'll make that clear to the reporters beforehand.
How are you going to handle Melissa Stewart?
We'll have to promise her something, Scanlon said. Something big.
Couldn't we just appeal to her sense of decency and patriotism?
We're talking about Melissa Stewart, Mr. President. I'm not sure she has a pulse, let alone a sense of patriotism.
The president exhaled heavily.
Whew! You can tell her the first interview I do after this is over will be with NBC News. That should make her happy.
That's going to cause me problems elsewhere in the press room, sir.
I'm afraid that those are your problems, Nick, not mine.
Would you like me to draft a statement for you, sir?
The president shook his head.
This one I can handle on my own.
Melissa Stewart was pulling on her overcoat and preparing to head for the north lawn when the telephone in her booth rang.
Cutting it close, don't you think?
I'm sorry, Melissa. For a moment I forgot that you're the center of the universe.
I'm late for an important live shot, Nick.
Cancel it.
What have you got for me?
The president is going into the briefing room in 20 minutes to tell the world that the Sword of Allah is holding Elizabeth Halton hostage and is demanding the release of Sheikh Abdullah.
Before his appearance, you may report that NBC News has learned that Elizabeth Halton is being held by Egyptian militants, and that the president is expected to say more on the situation. If you stick to the script, your network will get the first exclusive with the president when this affair is over. If you don't, I'll devote the rest of my time at the White House to making your life miserable.
Do we have a deal?
I believe we do.
See you in the briefing room in 10 minutes, and don't try to slip one past me, Melissa. I'll be listening carefully.
The President of the United States stepped to the podium in the White House briefing room at precisely 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time and informed the world that his goddaughter had been taken hostage by the Egyptian terror group known as the Sword of Allah. In exchange for Elizabeth's release, said the President, the terrorists had demanded that the United States free Sheikh Abdullah Abdul Razak. It was a demand, the President made clear, that would never be met. He called on the terrorists to release Elizabeth immediately, warned them and their sponsors that they would be brought to justice, and thanked the American people for their prayers and support. At 1:32, the president stepped away from the podium and left Nicholas Scanlon, his press secretary, to face the stunned press corps alone. Adrian Carter pressed the mute button on his remote control and looked toward the door of his office, where Shepard Cantwell, the deputy director for intelligence,
was standing in his shirt sleeves and suspenders.
"What did you think?" Cantwell asked.
Carter hesitated before answering. Shepard Cantwell only asked questions of others when he wanted to venture an opinion of his own. Cantwell couldn't help it. He was analysis.
"I thought he did as well as expected under the circumstances," Carter said. "He made it clear to the Sword that we won't be held hostage and that we won't negotiate."
"You're assuming that's what the Sword really wants, to negotiate. I'm not so sure about that."
Cantwell came into Carter's office and sat down.
"Our analysts have been poring over every word Sheikh Tayyip Abdul Razak has ever written or said publicly. Sermons, fatwas, transcripts of interviews, anything we can lay our hands on. A couple of years ago, he gave an interview to an Arabic-language newspaper from London under conditions of extreme secrecy somewhere inside Egypt. During the interview, the Sheikh was asked to name the most likely scenario under which the Islamists might seize power in Egypt. An election, a coup, or a popular uprising. The Sheikh was very clear in his response. He said the only way the Islamists will ever seize power in Egypt is by inciting the masses to rise up against their oppressors. Demonstrations, rioting, clashes in the street with the army. An intifada of sorts from the Nile Delta to Upper Egypt.
What's your point, Chef?
Sheikh Tayyip is a religious fanatic and mass murderer who also happens to be a very shrewd and clever character. The fact that he is still alive after all these years is proof of that. He had to know we would never bow to his demands to release his brother in exchange for Elizabeth Halton. But maybe he doesn't really want his brother. Maybe what he really wants is his uprising.
And he gets his uprising by provoking a confrontation with us?
At this moment, the Egyptian security services are tearing the country to pieces in order to help the infidel Americans find the daughter of a billionaire ambassador. Cantwell said. Think how that must look to an Egyptian Islamist who lives in desperate poverty, who's lost a brother or a father to Mubarak's torture chambers. Those torture chambers are filling up as we speak, and they're filling because the regime is looking for one American woman.
How bad is the situation in Egypt right now?
The reports we're getting from Cairo Station say it's extremely bad. In fact, it's worse than anyone there has ever seen it. If this goes on much longer, Sheikh Tayyip is going to get his uprising, and history is going to remember our president as the man who lost Egypt.
Cantwell stood and started to leave, then stopped and turned suddenly.
One more thing, he said. The president just sent our friend the Sphinx a very clear message. I wouldn't be surprised if the Sphinx sent one in return. If I were you, I'd get on the phone to Homeland Security and raise the National Threat Advisory immediately.
How high?
Red, said Cantwell as he slipped from the room. Blood red.
Carter looked at his watch. It was 1:37 p.m. The Muslim evening prayer had just begun in Amsterdam. He stared at his telephone and waited for it to ring.
Chapter 24. Oud West, Amsterdam, 7:09 p.m., Monday. A gust of cold wind froze Ibrahim Fawaz in his tracks as he pulled open the door of the Al-Hishra Mosque. This was his 25th winter in Holland, and still he was not accustomed to the cold. Providence and fate had brought him here, to this garden of cinder block and cement in northern Europe. But in his heart, he was still an Ibn Balad from Upper Egypt, a son of the soil and a child of the river. He stood in the vestibule for a moment, turning up his coat collar and tightening his scarf, then stepped tentatively into the street under the watchful gaze of two rosy-cheeked Amsterdam policemen. He exchanged pleasantries with them in fluent Dutch, then turned and set out along the Jan Hazenstraat. The two police officers were now a permanent fixture outside the mosque. The Al-Hishra had been searched twice by Dutch investigators in the wake of the attack in London. Files and computers had been seized, and the imam and several of his associates had been questioned about their knowledge of Samir al-Masri and the other members of his cell. Tonight, the imam had accused the infidels of using the attacks in London and the murder of Solomon Rosner as justification for a crackdown against Islam in the Netherlands. Ibrahim Fawaz had lived through a crackdown against Muslims before,
one that had been conducted with a ruthlessness and savagery that the Europeans, even in their worst nightmares, could scarcely imagine. The Imam was only using the police investigation as a pretext to stir up trouble. But then, that was what the Imam did best. That was why the Imam had been sent to Amsterdam in the first place. A car overtook him. Ibrahim saw his shadow stretch on the pavement in front of him, then disappear as the car slid past. When it was gone, he found that he was in pitch darkness. It seemed that three lamps near the end of the street were no longer burning. In the small park on the embankment of the canal, a man was seated alone on one of the benches. He had a pinched face, haunted dark eyes, and was as thin as Nile reed grass. A heroin addict, he thought. They were all over Amsterdam. They came from Europe and America to take advantage of Holland's permissive drug laws and the generous welfare benefits, and, once hooked, many never found the power or the will to leave again. Ibrahim lowered his gaze to the pavement and rounded the corner. The sight that greeted him next was far more offensive to his Islamic sensibilities than that of a heroin addict sitting alone in a freezing park. It was also a sight he saw all too often in Amsterdam. Two men in leather groping each other in the darkness against the side of a Volkswagen van. Ibrahim stopped suddenly, outraged by the shamelessness of the act he was witnessing, unsure of whether he should hurry past with his gaze averted or flee in the opposite direction. He decided on the second course of action. But before he could move, the side door of the van slid open, and a small, troll-like figure reached out and seized him by the throat. Then the two men in leather suddenly lost all interest in each other and turned their passion on him. Someone clamped a hand over his mouth. Someone else squeezed the side of his neck in a way that made his entire body go limp. He heard the door slam shut and felt the van lurch forward. A voice in Arabic ordered him not to move or make a sound. After that, no one spoke. Ibrahim did not know who had taken him or where he was going. He was certain of only one thing. If he did not do exactly what his captors wanted, he would never see Amsterdam or his wife again. He closed his eyes and began to pray. An image rose from the deepest well of his memory, the image of a bloody child suspended from the ceiling of a torture chamber. "Not again," he prayed. "Dear Allah, please don't let it happen again." Part 3. The Sacrifice of Isaac. Chapter 25. Northern Germany. 10:18 p.m. Monday. The landlords of housekeeping referred to it as Site 22XB, but among the old hands it was known simply as Chateau Chamron. It stood 100 yards from an isolated farm road at the end of a rutted drive lined with bare plane trees. The roof was steeply pitched, and on that evening was covered by a dusting of brittle snow. The shutters were missing several slats and drooped at a vaguely drunken angle. In the woodwork of the front door jamb were four tiny perforations, evidence of a mezuzah removed a long time ago. The party that arrived at the house that evening entered not by the front door, but through the old servants' entrance off the rear courtyard. They came in four vehicles, a Volkswagen van, two matching Renault sedans, and a rather flashy Audi A8, and had anyone inquired about the purpose of their visit, they would have spoken of a long-planned reunion of old friends. A cursory inspection of the house would have supported their story. The kitchen had been well stocked with food and liquor, and the hearth in the drawing-room had been laid with seasoned firewood. A more careful check of the premises, however, would have revealed that the once formal dining-room had been made ready for an interrogation, and that the house contained several pieces of sophisticated communications equipment unavailable on any commercial market. Such an examination might also have revealed that the small limestone chamber in the basement had been turned into a holding cell, and that the cell was now occupied by an Egyptian man of late middle age who was blindfolded, shackled, and stripped to his underwear. Gabriel regarded him silently for a moment, then climbed the stairs to the pantry, where Yaakov was standing with Sarah at his side.
"How long has he been in there?" Gabriel asked.
"A little over an hour," replied Yaakov.
"Any problems?"
Yaakov shook his head. "We got out of Amsterdam cleanly, and he behaved himself nicely during the ride."
"Did you have to use drugs on him?"
"It wasn't necessary."
"What about force?"
"I may have given him a couple love taps, but nothing he'll ever remember."
Did anyone speak in front of him?
Just a few words in Arabic. Ibrahim did a bit of talking, though. He's convinced he's in the hands of the Americans.
Good, thought Gabriel. That was exactly what he wanted Ibrahim to think. He led Sarah into the drawing room, where Dina and Ramona were reading the Sword of Allah dossiers before crackling fire, then slipped through a pair of double doors into the dining room. It was empty, except for the rectangular table and two high-backed chairs. Mordecai was balanced on one of the chairs, fitting a miniature transmitter into the cobwebbed chandelier.
This one's the backup!
He leaped down off the chair and wiped his dusty hands against the legs of his trousers.
The primary microphone is down here.
He tapped the tabletop. Put Ibrahim in this chair. That way the mic won't miss a thing he says.
What about the secure link?
It's up and running,
Mordecai said.
I'll feed the signal live to Kingsall Boulevard, and they'll bounce it to Langley. Based on what we're picking up from the Americans, you're the hottest ticket in town tonight.
Mordecai walked out of the room and closed the doors behind him. Sarah looked around at the blank walls.
Surely there's a good story behind this place, she said. Before the war, it was owned by a prominent Jewish family named Rosenthal, Gabriel said.
And when the war broke out?
It was confiscated by an SS officer, and the Rosenthal family was deported to Auschwitz. A daughter managed to survive and reclaim the property, but in the 50s she gave up on trying to stay here and immigrated to Israel. The German people weren't terribly kind to their fellow countrymen who managed to survive the Holocaust.
And the house?
She never sold it. When Shamron found out she still owned it, he convinced her to let us have use of it. Shamron always had a way of tucking things away for a rainy day. Houses, passports, people. We used it as a safe house and staging point during the Wrath of God operation. Eli and I spent many long nights here. Some good, some not so good.
Sarah lowered herself into the chair that would soon be occupied by Ibrahim Fawaz and folded her hands on the table.
What's going to happen here tonight? She asked.
That depends entirely on Ibrahim. If he cooperates and tells me the truth, then things will go very smoothly. If he doesn't...
Gabriel shrugged.
Yaakov is one of Shabak's most skilled interrogators. He knows how to talk to men who aren't afraid of death. It's possible things might get unpleasant.
How unpleasant?
Are you asking me whether we will torture him?
That's exactly what I'm asking.
My goal tonight is to create an ally, Sarah. And one doesn't create an ally with clubs and fists.
What if Ibrahim doesn't want to be your ally?
Then he might soon find himself in a place where men aren't shy about using extremely violent methods to extract information. But let us hope it doesn't come to that, for all our sakes.
You don't approve of torture?
I wish I could say it doesn't work, but that's not the case. Done properly by trained professionals, placing physical and emotional stress on captured terrorists very often produces actionable intelligence that saves lives. But at what cost to the societies and security services that engage in it?
A very high cost, unfortunately. It puts us in the same league as the Egyptians and the Jordanians and the Saudis and every other brutal Arab secret police force that tortures its opponents. And ultimately, it does harm to our cause because it turns believers into fanatics.
You condemn torture, but have no qualms about killing?
No qualms. He shook his head slowly. Killing takes its toll, too. But I'm afraid killing is our only recourse. We have to kill the monsters before they kill us, and not with boots on the ground, as you Americans like to say, because that only gives the terrorists another moral victory when we invade their territory. The killing has to take place in the shadows, where no one can see it. We have to hunt them down ruthlessly. We have to terrorize them. He looked at her again.
Welcome to our war, Sarah. You are now a true citizen of the night.
Thanks to you. I've been a citizen of the night for several months now.
There was a knock at the door. It was Yaakov.
I think he's ready to talk.
You're sure? Yaakov nodded.
Give him 10 more minutes, Gabriel said.
Then bring him to me. They bore him carefully up the stairs and deposited him, still blindfolded and with his hands bound behind his back, in his designated seat.
He made no protest, requested nothing, and revealed no sign of any fear. Indeed, he seemed to Gabriel like a martyr heroically waiting for the executioner's axe to fall. It had been dark in the cellar. Now, in the proper light, Gabriel could see his skin was covered in dark blotches. After allowing several minutes to elapse, he reached across the table and removed the blindfold. The Egyptian squinted in the sudden light, then opened his eyes slowly and glared malevolently at Gabriel across the divide.
"Where am I? You are in a great deal of trouble. Why have you kidnapped me?"
"No one has kidnapped you. You have been taken into custody."
"By whom? For what reason?"
"By the Americans, and we both know the reason."
"If I am in the hands of the Americans, then why are you here?"
"Because, obviously, I was the one who told them about you."
"So much for your assurances about protecting me."
"Those assurances were nullified the moment it became clear that you lied to me."
"I did no such thing."
"Really?
I told you everything I knew about the plot. If you and your British friends had acted more quickly, you might have been able to prevent it."
The Egyptian appraised him silently for a moment.
"I enjoyed reading about your checkered past in the newspapers, Mr. Alon. I had no idea I was dealing with such an important man that night in Amsterdam."
Gabriel placed a file on the table and slid it across the divide so that it came to rest in front of Ibrahim. The Egyptian looked down at it for a long moment, then lifted his gaze once more to Gabriel.
"Where did you get this?
Where do you think?" He managed a superior smile.
"The Americans, the Jews, and the Egyptian secret police. The unholy trinity. And you wonder why you are loathed by the Arabs.
Our time together is limited, Ibrahim. You can waste it delivering another one of your lectures, or you can use it wisely by telling me everything you know about the kidnapping of the American woman."
"I don't know anything."
"You're lying, Ibrahim. I am telling you the truth."
"You are a member of the Sword of Allah."
"No."
"I was a member. I left the sword when I left Egypt."
"Yes, I remember.
You came to Europe for a better life, isn't that what you told me?"
"But it isn't true, is it?"
"You were dispatched to Europe by your friend Sheikh Tayeb to establish an operational cell in Amsterdam. The Al-Hijra Mosque, the West Amsterdam Islamic Community Center. They're both Sword of Allah fronts, aren't they, Ibrahim?"
"If I am an active member of the Sword of Allah, then why was I working with your spy, Solomon Rosner? Why did I tell him about the plot to shoot down your jetliner? And why did I warn you about Samir al-Masri and his friends from the Al-Hijra Mosque?"
"All valid questions. And you have exactly 30 minutes to answer them to my satisfaction. 30 minutes to tell me everything you know about the operation to kidnap Elizabeth Halton. Otherwise, I'll be asked to leave, and the Americans will take over. They're angry right now, Ibrahim. And you know what happens when Americans get angry. They resort to methods that go against their nature. You Israelis do far worse."
Gabriel cast a desultory glance at his wristwatch.
"You're wasting time."
"But then maybe that's your plan. You think you can hold out until the deadline expires."
4 days is a long time to hold out, Ibrahim. It cannot be done. Start talking, Ibrahim. Confess."
This is the end of disc number 5. Please continue listening on disc number 6.